We've got some fascinating interviews from Rebel Media in Canada, and they tie right in with Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Welcome to the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, and I'm delighted to tell you about our show that's coming your way today. In this first hour, we're going to interview two Jewish activists, two folks that are conservative Jews and in the center of controversy, one especially in Canada, one more so in the States, Ezra Levant and Laura Loomer. It's going to be fascinating to talk with them, especially to find out why Ezra, a Jewish man, has a burden to help Christians in Iraq and to fight against the genocide of Christians. And what issue is it that they have with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, the Jewish-run Anti-Defamation League? We'll be talking about that with Ezra first and with Laura shortly. Also in the second hour, what I want to do is dig into the Hebrew Scriptures, dig into the Hebrew Bible, and give you some insights into how we get some of our English translations, how we get some of our right understandings and wrong understandings from the Hebrew into English. And if you have a call for me about that, anything relating to the Hebrew Bible, anything relating to translation of the Hebrew Bible, I'll be taking your calls in the second hour today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Make sure you have the number ready, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. You know what's interesting? I did a show second hour on Monday talking about strengths and weaknesses of the King James Bible, and I plan over time just to do a series and single out a version or genre versions, you know, paraphrases or dynamic translations or things like that, and talk about strengths and weaknesses. But it's right, of course, to start with the King James, the most famous and influential English translation of them all. So we talked about strengths and weaknesses and took about 45 minutes or so to do that, and then posted the video where we also took calls, posted that the next day. So one day later, it's been viewed thousands of times and probably a couple hundred comments by now. In other words, attracting a lot of attention. And a lot of people want to discuss the Greek manuscripts behind the King James. They want to discuss Byzantine versus Alexandrian and which is the better text to use for the New Testament. And it's an important discussion, and it's a worthy discussion. But it's not my primary focus. And plenty of other scholars have debated that back and forth. My scholarship is not in New Testament textual criticism. Now, I'm happy to get involved in the discussion and correct erroneous concepts out there on whatever side they are. But all that being said, my issue always goes back to Hebrew Bible first. In other words, that's my area of scholarship. When I'm evaluating a translation, that's the first thing I'm looking at as someone that can read the original Hebrew and works in the original Hebrew and has written commentaries on the original Hebrew. So I'm perfectly happy if someone said, I'm convinced that we use the Textus Receptus, the majority text, and we use the Byzantine manuscripts, etc. And I'm not even going to argue that, although I differ with it. I'm not even going to argue with that as a hill to die on. I would simply say that there are better ways to translate things. The King James made errors here. The NIV makes errors here. I believe the NASB has errors here. Just things like that. And we do our best to be honest and objective. So when we come back, I'm going to introduce to you Ezra Levant. He's a human rights activist, author, TV host, and dad. And as his bio says, he's not, to everyone's taste, chosen in 2014 as the most irritating Canadian by the Globe and Mail's TV critic. Interesting. Also been called the biggest name in Canadian broadcasting.
want, for fire we please.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In a moment, I'm going to be joined by Ezra Levant. 2009, he wrote a best-selling book. He's Canadian. Shakedown: How Our Government is Undermining Democracy in the Name of Human Rights. And there's a lot that we can learn from Canada, things that have gone wrong there, things that are real assaults on human rights. There's a lot that's been done that is not right in Canada. Canada's a different nation than America. We're neighbors. We share a common language for the most part. A lot of cultural overlap, but we're two different countries, and the religious communities in each country are different. The church in each country different in terms of influence and things like that, especially the evangelical church. But there's a lot that's happened in Canada in terms of the removal of certain human rights, the removal of certain freedoms in the name of human rights. So there's a lot that we can learn from Canada and even the birthing of rebel media with Ezra Levant. So we'll be talking to Ezra, just trying to make a Skype connection here. And as soon as we have that, we will begin. Let me just say a few things first. I have an article up today, a prophetic warning to Christian universities. A prophetic warning to Christian universities. And in that article, I mentioned the words of Jesus, who said, if you save your life, you'll lose it. If you lose your life for my sake and the gospel, you will find it. And in point of fact, Jesus is telling us something that applies to every one of us. If we try to save our reputation, if we try to save our public honor, if we try to preserve our safety, and have everyone like us, we lose our lives. We lose our souls. We become slaves to popular opinion. We become slaves to what people think is right. We become slaves to the spirit of the hour. If we say, I'm going to do what's right regardless, I'm going to honor God regardless, we may lose our lives, but we then save them. Do you follow? It's like Dr. Martin Luther King said, a man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is right. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for that which is true. A man dies when he refuses to stand up for justice. So that's the lesson, friends, for Christian universities. When the spirit of the age comes to you and says, if you want to keep your accreditation, you must compromise your values here and here and here. If you want to receive federal funding, you must make changes here and here and here. If you want to play with the NCAA, if you want to be part of collegiate athletics, you're going to have to compromise here, 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 or revise your standards here, here, and here. If we're told that, we say, okay, fine, we'll go the easy way. We lose our souls in the process. All right. Let me welcome to The Line of Fire Ezra Levant of Rebel Media. Ezra, thanks for joining us on the broadcast today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Ezra, tell me how Rebel Media got its birth.
Sure. Well, there was about 200 of us working for a national conservative TV network. It was jokingly called Fox News North.
Yep.
And after 4 years, though, they pulled the plug on us because we never were able to get the cable carriage that our competitors had, because the government TV regulator, like your FCC, would not give us the same standing as the other all-news channels. They basically euthanized us. Mm. They decided they didn't want a conservative political voice. And you can imagine if the Democrats could pull the plug on Fox News, they would.
Yeah, that's absolutely what happened. And I remember being on Sun, which was the network then, some years ago with one of your colleagues, and we were talking about a book I'd written on homosexuality, and I thought, how in the world is this airing? Because I knew there were restrictions in Canada.
Well, and alas, that network came to an end. But we decided, I mean, 8 of us from the wreckage of the Sun said, well, let's try it online. And now we've grown to 50 staff, and we have millions of views every month on the internet, and we don't have the same regulatory restrictions. So the internet is still fairly free in Canada, but I heard your preamble there. You're absolutely right. Americans must very strongly defend the First Amendment, because Canada is a cautionary tale about what happens when you don't. We don't have a First Amendment here. So we have all sorts of censorship laws, sometimes in the real courts, sometimes in kangaroo courts called human rights commissions. We have a new anti-Islamophobia motion that basically is going to crack down on anyone who is skeptical of Islam, the doctrine. Why shouldn't we be able to criticize Islam or any other faith? That's part of the separation of mosque and state. We're losing our ability to criticize. And I'm worried that in Canada, Americans should look to Canada as a cautionary tale, the same way we look to Europe as what's 5 years down the road for us if we don't protect our freedoms.
Yeah, and when you mentioned some of the restrictions, the bill that's being considered now about criticizing Islam, which would then be, quote, Islamophobia, you also have this say with transgender activism, Professor Jordan Peterson being perhaps the best-known voice from Canada on this. What's happening nationally on that front?
Well, it's funny you mentioned him. Just 2 days ago, YouTube shut down Professor Jordan Peterson's account. He's very big on YouTube, 360,000 subscribers. Mm-hmm. And because he speaks so bluntly, and that transgender language bill was exactly what thrust him into the spotlight. He said, I'm simply going to call a man and a woman, and I'm not going to do what the left says and say, what's your pronouns, je and jer and there and that. Like, he said, I'm sorry, you can't tell me what to say. If I see a man, I'll say he. If I see a woman, I'll say her. And they tried to crack down on him, but he wouldn't buckle. So he was a real star. They took away his research funding.
Yep.
He crowdfunded it. But then YouTube shocked everyone 2 days ago, took down his YouTube account. They did later put it back up. But that's a reminder that censorship in the 21st century is not just from governments. It's from Silicon Valley titans in liberal California, in liberal San Francisco, who quite often don't respect Christian views, conservative views, pro-First Amendment, pro-Second Amendment views. So the threats to freedom don't just come from governments, but from YouTube, Google, Twitter, Facebook, places like that.
And what's really extreme here is when you realize that Professor Peterson's concerns arose out of him studying communism for years and the thought police and forced speech and expression. And when he saw the same thing coming on another front, he knew he had to stand up. And really his worst fears in that sense are being confirmed. And the university where he teaches has told him, if there's a lawsuit against you, we're not going to stand with you.
It's amazing. Professor Peterson, if he were on the left, he would be called a star professor.
Yeah, yeah.
He's internationally known. His students love him. I've never seen such devotion by students. He's charismatic. He's prolific. He would be the toast of the town. He'd win a Nobel Prize if he were on the left. But because he is right wing, but what he says to me isn't particularly radical. In fact, 25 years ago, probably someone who called themselves a classical liberal would say what he's saying. The fact that he is marginally on the right, he is utterly demonized, and the university couldn't wait to throw him overboard. I think they realize he's got a big public profile now. He can fight back in a way that he couldn't before. He has so many supporters, but it's appalling the lack of academic freedom he has. And it's, you know what's so sad is in the past, the academy used to say, we're for free speech, even for radical ideas.
Yeah.
That's what Berkeley was all about in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now Berkeley has censorship riots, and universities are trying to censor Professor Peterson. Those leftists never meant it. I think they just meant it for themselves. Freedom for themselves, censorship for their enemy.
You know, what's even more ironic is that Richard Dawkins was invited by a liberal radio station to give a talk at Berkeley. And a few weeks before it, they canceled out, saying we were not aware of his criticisms of Islam, which have offended others. Like, you got to be kidding me. And Dawkins said, oh, I can criticize Christianity. That's okay, but I can't criticize Islam. And a progressive station is now dropping me. But there's the hypocrisy of the so-called progressive left.
Yeah, and there's another comedian named Ricky Gervais from the United Kingdom who is a real specialist at skewering Christians. Boring. I've seen that a million times. You want to be a dramatic shock artist? Take a run at Mohammed. Draw Mohammed. Draw a cartoon of Mohammed. Don't even be crude about it. Just draw a stick man. You want to be edgy? Do that. Going after Jesus and Christians is boring and safe and lowbrow. These so-called edgy, I mean, Dawkins, I think, got a taste of it. But Ricky Gervais is another one. I don't know if you know who I mean. He was in the British version of The Office. I think he's funny some of the times, but he's so obviously, you know, I think it was Voltaire, I'm not sure who it was, who said, if you want to know who has power over you, see who you cannot criticize. Ricky Gervais is so happy to criticize Christianity, he doesn't dare mention the word Mohammed or Islam. He's terrified. He actually has Islamophobia. He's afraid of Islam, and with good reason.
Yes.
You criticize a Christian, they don't cut your head off. You criticize Mohammed, you might get the Charlie Hebdo treatment and be shot dead.
All right, let's talk about this. We come back. What's happening to Christians at the Sword of Islam?
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My guest has been called the most irritating Canadian and the biggest name in Canadian broadcasting. One of his books, bestseller, Shakedown, How Our Government is Undermining Democracy in the Name of Human Rights. Ezra Levant. Friends, if you've never gone to Rebel Media at YouTube, go there and you'll see why they have all the attention they have. And Ezra, just for your information, when I'm researching a story and I see you have a video on it, I think, good, that's reliable. This guy is reliable. So as much as people may think that some of what's reported is incendiary, what makes it incendiary is that you're telling the truth.
Well, that's the thing. The truth can sometimes be disturbing. It can be enraging. It can be thrilling. Can I tell you about a recent documentary trip I went on with four of my colleagues?
Please.
We went to Iraq, and the idea of going to Iraq on purpose, unless you're there as a soldier to liberate it, is terrifying. But we wanted to go see the plight of ancient Christians. There are Christian communities in Iraq that date back 1,500 years. They still pray in the ancient language of Aramaic.
Yeah, they use Aramaic, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Jesus' language. So these are Christians who were amongst the first followers of Jesus. And these towns, they lived in ethnically homogenous towns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, originally that area was all Christian, but then over time Islam marched through. And so then there's pockets of Christian towns, and they've had it hard for centuries, let's be candid. But nothing prepared them for what happened until 2014, when the Islamic State roared through northern Iraq and parts of Syria. And all these Christian towns were targeted for ethnic cleansing. And so the Islamic State would come to a town and issue an edict. And Christians would have three choices: convert, pay the submissive jizya tax, and be basically under the Nuremberg laws of Islam.
Yeah, second-class citizens in the lowest way. Yeah.
Die. And so we went into towns where every single Christian was cleansed. They fled because they didn't want to be murdered. And finally, some of these towns have been liberated. I walked into a town. Let me tell you about this one town called Batnaya. I walked in there. It had been liberated, but not yet repopulated. There were still some unexploded ordnance. 80% of the structures were damaged in some way. It was really like being in Stalingrad. And it was quite eerie. We were the only people in this whole town. You could walk right into someone's home and see there, you know, there's soap and shampoo in the shower. Like, it was eerie. I felt like maybe someone would have felt going into a Jewish town, a shtetl, in Poland in 1945 after all the Jews were disappeared, either killed or fled. And there were so many analogies. I'm Jewish myself, and I've always had a tremendous gratitude and affection for the righteous Gentiles who in the Holocaust saved Jews. And so I look at these Christians and the anti-Christian Holocaust of the Middle East, and I think surely Jews have an obligation to speak up for these Christians. Let me give you a few quick analogies.
Please.
Under Nazi Germany, Jews had to wear a yellow Star of David to mark them. Under the Islamic State, Christian houses had an Arabic letter called a nun, like an N, for Nazarenes and following Jesus of Nazareth. They marked them for death. Under the Nazis, they destroyed synagogues and Jewish cemeteries. I was in Batnaya. I saw the church there. Every single cross had been snapped. Gunfire. They used the cross on a prayer book as a mark for a target practice, as a bullseye. They torched the church, and they sprayed anti-Christian graffiti in the church. They smashed every window. They smashed the crosses in the cemetery, just like Jewish cemeteries in Europe and Kristallnacht in 1930s in Germany. The world didn't care. The world turned a blind eye. Where is the Christian world? Where's the secular world? Where's the Western world caring about Christian refugees? Lots of talk about Muslim refugees, but no one's got a genocide against Muslim refugees. No one's genociding Muslims. There is a deliberate ethnic cleansing of Christians in Iraq. There's so many similarities. I guess one more thing is the Nazis tried to extirpate the Jewish fact of certain towns and cities to try and wipe out all history. And I was in this church in Batnaya, and I saw graffiti written in Arabic and even in German. So you had Muslim Germans coming to Syria and Iraq to rape and kill. And let me tell you what some of the graffiti was. I know it from memory. It was, "You cross slaves." That's what they called Christians. Mm. "You have no place in an Islamic land. Flee or we will kill you." And they wanted to take that land back for Mohammed, for Allah, and to end 1,400 years of Christianity. And you know what the tragedy is? They're succeeding. So many of those Christians who fled, I don't think they want to go back. It would be like a Jew going back to a tiny Jewish shtetl, little town in Germany or Poland in 1946. Are you really going to go back? And that's the sad thing for me, is the ethnic cleansing of Christians there. I think, I hate to say it, it's been successful. The Christian population of Iraq is now just down to a percent or two. It used to be much more.
Yeah, and Ezra, of course, it's Iraq in the heart of it, but Syria and some of the other surrounding nations. You're talking about the displacement, the slaughter, the persecution of several million people. It is an ethnic cleansing. It is a genocide of Middle Eastern Christians in front of our eyes. And you're right, very little has been done about it. And right now, under President Trump, the number of Christian refugees coming into America has been upped. It was infinitesimally small under President Obama, but we're even fighting out in America to not have some of these Iraqi Christians sent back to Iraq. So it is a horror story, and it moves me that you as a Jew are involved. I'm a Messianic Jew, so I have a connection with the Christians there, and we have workers there in northern Iraq. But for you as a Jewish Canadian to get involved, it means a lot and should mean a lot to our listeners. Where can folks go to find out about what you're doing and how they can be involved?
Well, thank you very much for asking. If you go to SaveTheChristians.com, that's a website we set up about our trip, SaveTheChristians.com, and you'll see two things there. You'll see 15 videos that we made in these towns, in the town of Batnaya, in the town of Telescof. You'll see refugee camps of the forgotten ones, of Christian-only refugee camps. Because remember, if you're a Christian and you go to the Muslim refugee camp, they'll still persecute you in the refugee camp. That's why there's so few Christian refugees coming to America, because the places the refugees are drawn from, these United Nations refugee camps, they beat up Christians there too. So there's 15 videos on SaveTheChristians.com, and we've also set up a little humanitarian fund. We're trying to raise money. We found a Christian pharmacy in the town of Ankawa in Erbil. So this is where all the Christians who were pushed out of these towns, they've come to this town. They pushed out of these little towns. They've come to Ankawa, and there's this Christian doctor and pharmacist, and there's some nuns there. And we spent some time with them, because it's, you want to be careful when you're giving out money in a low-trust society, that it's not just ripped off. It's a very corrupt place, Iraq. They don't have Western standards of contracts and transparency. So we checked out about six different charities we were there.
Tell you what, just stay right there. We've just got a short break. We'll finish this on the other side of the break. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Let me encourage you again on YouTube to visit Rebel Media and then look up the videos first of Ezra Levant, who is the founder and leader of the rebels there. But you hear his heart. His heart is to do what is right, to do what is good, and to stand up for freedoms, not just for those in Canada, but for those persecuted and downtrodden, people who become second-class citizens, who are looked at as the pariahs. And yes, it's true that many Jews are sensitive to this because of our treatment in the past and our dispersion around the world. So, Ezra, back to you in terms of what you did in Erbil. And by the way, we've got workers there, grads from our ministry school, that serve in that very city and some of that very area. So what you're saying is so important to me. But back to you, sir.
Well, we're doing two things. I mentioned we did 15 little journalistic videos. We're putting together a larger documentary. My friend Faith Goldie is going to be the narrator of a larger documentary about Christian genocide. You can get information about that at SaveTheChristians.com. And we knew we would see terrible things, and so we're raising funds for this Christian pharmacy in Ain Kawa. There's $4.7 billion being spent on Muslim refugees. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, there's a lot of rich Persian Gulf countries. Muslim refugees are being well taken care of. How about someone take care of the Christians? So we're going to, at SaveTheChristians.com, we're actually have a crowdfund to help this Christian pharmacy in Ain Kawa, because they're being ignored. The UN is not giving the proper proportion of funds to the Christian refugees. They drive them away. Let the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the UN take care of the Muslim refugees. I want to focus on the Christians. So that was part of our project. Document the Christian genocide, give news updates from these towns, and then try and provide some relief to the Christians who survived and fled to Ain Kawa.
Let me ask you something. This will be challenging even for a media man like yourself, but in a minute or minute and a half, why so much more sympathy for Muslim refugees than Christian refugees? What do you think?
Well, I think it's an attempt of political correctness to show how open-minded we are. We'll care for the other before we even care for ourselves. People are afraid of being called racist. People are afraid of standing up for their own community. And the thing is, if Christians don't stand up for Christians, who will? The UN won't. Saudi Arabia won't. I'm not saying be hard-hearted to other people.
Absolutely.
I'm just saying, for goodness sakes, I've seen with my eyes the Christian refugees in northern Iraq are the forgotten refugees. They're the leftovers, but they're people, and they need help. That's the tragedy. The Muslim refugees are well taken care of by comparison. I think we got to focus, and that's why we set up this website, SaveTheChristians.com.
Yeah, and if you think, say, a country like Syria torn apart, and you've got Sunni versus Shia and Saudi Arabia versus Iran, the ones that are always caught between a rock and a hard place, they're the Christians. So, Ezra, thanks so much for what you're doing, both with Rebel Media, taking a stand for freedom and truth in Canada and beyond, and now with SaveTheChristians.com. Greatly appreciate it, and hope you have great success in your endeavors.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
My joy. All right, friends, when we come back, we are going to bring on another guest from Rebel Media. She lives in New York. She's also Jewish, and you may have heard about her in a little different context. And we want to bring in the issue of the ADL, the American Defamation League, how that ties in with YouTube and potential censorship, and how this affects Laura directly. So we'll get into all of that when we come back. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. Be sure to visit AskDrBrown.org, AskDrBrown.org. When you're there, check out our latest videos and articles. They're relevant. They're on point. You can use them to speak to others. I'm saying what you believe and feel, and we've got a great platform to do it. Just share them with others on your social media, and this way, together, we can make a difference. All right, friends, we'll be right back on the other side of the break. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You may have recently heard the name Laura Loomer. You're thinking, where did I hear that name? Well, here's a headline. New York Post, June 16th, 2017. Blogger booed off stage after rushing Julius Caesar. Now, notice this description from the New York Post. Laura Loomer, who works for the alt-right website The Rebel. So notice it's called alt-right, which would then make it anti-Semitic and even have Nazi undertones. That's how it's being framed. Laura Loomer, who works for the alt-right website The Rebel, ran onto the stage during the performance and was promptly dragged away and booed by the crowd. This, as you know, the infamous play in New York City, which basically depicted every night the assassination of Donald Trump. Not actually him, but an actor that was resembling and representing him to the delight of the crowd. And Laura Loomer, interestingly, as a conservative Jewish woman, took issue with that. In a moment, we'll let you hear the actual clip where Laura did this. But Laura, welcome to the Line of Fire. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Laura, could you just give us a little hint of your background? You're a young woman in your mid-20s. To do something like this takes a lot of guts, and you know it's going to bring a lot of backlash. How does this woman, Laura Loomer, get to do something like that? Give us a little bit of your history.
Well, I grew up in Arizona. I'm 24 years old, and I went to school in Florida. I studied political science and journalism, and I got started in journalism working for Project Veritas. So for about 3 years, I was working with James O'Keefe, and, you know, over the past 3 years, I just was carrying out various operations, various undercover missions, and you know, this desire to make a difference and create impact just grew on me. And I recently left Project Veritas to join The Rebel. And within probably less than 2 weeks of being there, I just decided that something needed to be done about, you know, the normalization of political violence against the right and its sponsorship by the left-wing mainstream media.
All right. So this was a conviction in your heart to stand up and do something. Why do that? It's just a lot easier to let people do what they do and live your life and not be involved in controversy. When you know you're going to get this kind of backlash, why are these convictions so strong in you?
Well, look, you know, people talk about making a difference but and wanting to change policies, but a lot of people aren't willing to do what's necessary to make it happen. And, you know, no one is going to like you. You know, not everybody in this world is going to like you no matter what you do. Someone once told me you could be the juiciest peach in the world, but there's always going to be somebody who hates peaches, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it's just part of the job. That's what happens.
Well, listen, I commend you for it. I understand it, relate to it. So many just sit by idly and complain. But here, let's just talk about this one thing and then the anti-Semitic related charges and your relationship with the ADL and these accusations of alt-right. So if you've got this queued up, let's just listen to what happened at this play in New York City.
Freedom. Stop the normalization of political violence against the right. This is unacceptable. You cannot.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to pause. We're going to pause. Security.
This is violent.
Security, please.
Laura, what do you think would have happened to you if there had been a play in New York City, which, God forbid, was depicting the assassination of Barack Obama every night, aside from the fact it never would have gone on, never would have happened, and you got up to protest it? What do you think the media would have said about you?
I mean, they would have glorified me, right? They would have put me on a pedestal and worshipped me and, you know, called me a symbol of hope and change. But look, we've seen this mentality in the mainstream media, one in which they try to completely demoralize Donald Trump and his supporters and, you know, just completely invalidate their legitimacy. So, I mean, it's obvious why the media reacted the way they did. I think one of the only, probably if not the only, positive response I received from any mainstream media, you know, reporters, journalists, was Sean Hannity. He's the only one who really commended me for what I did. But if you look at the breakdown of the play, they received something like $30 to $33 million of New York City taxpayer dollars, along with big sponsorships from the New York Times, Time Warner, and CNN. So why would the, you know, these big time liberal mainstream media outlets want to condemn something that they're supporting?
Right, so the hypocrisy is extraordinary. Hatred like this on either side is unacceptable. Acts of simulated violence like this against leaders on either side are unacceptable. If there had been a play like this, and again, President Obama, God forbid, was the target of it, and let's just say Fox News helped underwrite it, and you know, the Washington Times, conservative newspaper, helped underwrite it, they'd be blasted from pillar to post. That they'd be instantly boycotted. Yet the New York Times didn't skip a beat, and others that endorsed the play had hardly skipped a beat. It's extraordinary hypocrisy. And right now you're caught in the crosshairs of this, Laura, in particular because you are also a young Jewish woman, and young Jewish women, by definition in America, unless you're ultra-Orthodox religious, you are expected to be liberal. So this really isolates you further, doesn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, I've received hatred from both the left and the right for being Jewish. So it's not like, you know, it's one side and I can, like, run to one side of the aisle for, you know, solidarity and, you know, quote-unquote protection, because I'm kind of in the middle, where I have people on both sides of the aisle just trying to attack me, and not only just attacking me for their disagreement in my tactics, but just disagreeing with me simply because I'm Jewish.
Has it gotten that far? In other words, if someone looks at your Twitter feed, you've got a healthy following on Twitter, will they see attacks on you just because you're Jewish?
Yeah, definitely.
And has it gone beyond just rhetoric on Twitter or getting blasted by the media? Has there been anything that's physical or tangible that's happened beyond that?
For what, being Jewish or just being attacked in general?
Being who you are, has there been further backlash which has actually come in the way of a physical threat or something bodily that's happened?
Yeah, I've received threats. People will call my phone really late at night. Just last night, I probably received about like 15 calls in a row from unknown numbers. And people will leave me anti-Semitic voicemails. People will send me nasty text messages. If I answer the phone, they'll scream, you know, derogatory terms about Jewish people. And it honestly got so bad that I had to file a police report recently, because it wasn't just so much the attacks on me for being Jewish. It was the attacks on me in general and people threatening to harm me and kill me. And I've been receiving death threats. People have called me, some of them simply attacking me because I'm Jewish, others because I'm a conservative. And look, I don't know who's making these phone calls, right? I mean, I know a couple of them who they're coming from, but I'm not going to say that all of the hatred is coming from one specific group or one specific side of the aisle, because there's many people both on the left and the right who have attacked me simply for being Jewish and just simply because I'm a female Trump supporter.
And so, again, the more you narrow down who you are, the less and less commonality you have with others of your age and background, et cetera. What about the tires of your car? Did they suffer recently?
Yeah. And so yesterday, my tire was slashed, one tire. And, you know, instantly people were just taking to Twitter to condemn me and call me a liar, say that I wanted to raise shekels, trying to you know, discredit me and the threats that I've been receiving. And I know that people are going to do this. So this is why I've been keeping a track record of everything, because I know that people are going to try and discredit me. And honestly, like, for anybody who's receiving threats like this, I, you know, would encourage them to make a police report and document it, because God forbid something does actually happen to me, at least there will be a record that, yeah, I received death threats, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, somebody slashed my tire. And I keep receiving hateful phone calls and voicemails. So, you know, I filed a police report. I'm getting, my car is actually getting fixed right now. And the police documented that my tire was slashed. AAA documented that my tire was slashed. And the four mechanics who were in the shop all saw my car, and before I even opened my mouth and told them what happened, one of them goes, "Wow, who did you piss off?" Because it was so obvious that my tire had been slashed upon seeing it.
Mm. All right, friends, we come back. I want to add one more element to the story here that makes it all the more shocking. We're going to talk about the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. This is the Jewish-run Anti-Defamation League that focuses on the defamation of Jewish people. We'll be right back.
Give us strength to always do what's right.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I'm speaking with Laura Loomer. You can watch her videos at Rebel Media on YouTube. Laura is a conservative activist, and she is Jewish and a supporter of Trump, so you don't get that all together in many cases. And friends listening, whether you love President Trump or hate President Trump or you're somewhere in between, I think you agree that everyone should have the right to their beliefs and no one should encourage violence and hatred against those with whom they differ. You might say, well, thank God for the ADL, Anti-Defamation League. Thank God they exist, because when a Jew like Laura is getting publicly defamed and attacked, just go to her Twitter feed and see. Simply because she is Jewish, thank God there is such a thing as the ADL. Well, Laura has not found a friend and a sympathizer with the Anti-Defamation League. Listen to what happened with her. This is Laura speaking from the ADL building.
Apparently, if you are a conservative Jew and you come to the ADL and you come to report hatred and defamation and cyberbullying of conservatives, you are not welcome here at the ADL. They claim to be one of the leading organizations that protects people against defamation, against cyberbullying, against attacks, and anti-Semitism, but they won't even let an American Jew, a Jewish conservative American woman, go upstairs and have a conversation with them about the defamation and this hatred that they're spewing against conservatives. They're willing to call out and target conservatives, but I haven't seen one list in which they identify American Muslim leaders who preach anti-Semitism and claim that Israel doesn't have a right to exist, yet they're defaming conservatives and creating a list of undesirables. It sounds like they don't really defend all Jews. It sounds like they don't really have the interests of all Jews, only Democratic Jews.
All right, Laura, what you're saying is that the ADL is there to stand up for liberal Jewish causes and liberal Jews, but not conservative Jews. And in fact, they put out a list from alt-right to alt-right naming the hate, where one of your colleagues is on there as well, as if he's a Nazi sympathizer or a Jew hater or something like that. What's going on? Where is this double standard coming from?
Well, I think it's really easy to call somebody a Nazi or call somebody a white supremacist, because those words, they've really just lost their meaning, right? Because people have used them so much and they throw them around like common adjectives to the point where people don't really think before they accuse somebody or defame someone by using those words, which were once, you know, really vile accusations. Now people just think nothing of it. And so I also think that it's clearly their agenda, because any of those people could see that, you know, half the people on those lists are either friends with Jews, they're either working for Jewish people, they're married to Jews, they have Jewish friends. And yeah, they are correct in that there are some Jew haters on the list. I'm not denying that. But to just accuse everybody on the list of being a white supremacist or a Nazi without really doing any research and, you know, just to put such a defamatory label on them is shocking to me. And I know a lot of these people and I'm friends with some of them, others not so much, but I felt it was my duty as a Jew and a member of the New Right to question the ADL and criticize them for their defamatory list that they publish. It's funny because they claim to fight defamation, but then by putting out a hit list, a target list, which is like the same exact thing Hitler did. He created lists of undesirables and released it to the public so that the public could target those undesirables. They're defaming people. So tell me how the ADL is supposed to be committing itself to fighting defamation and anti-Semitism when they themselves are actually increasing defamation and creating anti-Semitism by creating more resentment towards Jews since, you know, this false list came from a Jewish organization. I know a lot of people may not agree with me, but I believe that anti-Semitism is largely fueled and promoted by the Jewish people themselves. I think that you have left-leaning Jews who have chosen to align themselves with liberal causes, anti-Israel causes, Islam, you know, pro-Muslim immigration, and those are things that conservatives are generally against. And so by doing that and by basically advocating for and promoting the destruction of the West, of Western values, of democracy through these toxic policies and viewpoints, obviously people are going to have resentment towards Jewish people.
Yeah, and of course, on the larger scale, I look at anti-Semitism as a historic demonic plague and the world's longest hatred and deepest hatred and most irrational hatred. So it's going to be here regardless of Jewish behavior. However, I do agree with you that when you have Jewish people driving something like the ACLU in so many ways and so many extreme left-wing causes that come against religious liberties and conservative values, or someone like George Soros underwriting so much of what many Americans differ with and are displeased with, and he himself a Hungarian Jew, yeah, it does not help our cause. And then, of course, when you start coming up with the list, yeah, some people are anti-Semites, some people are rightly identified as Nazi sympathizers. But I was put on a list years ago by the SPLC, along with David Duke, former Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and others, former head of the Black Panthers and things like that. I was put on a list because as a Messianic Jew, conservative evangelical, I differed with gay activism. So that got me on their hate list. So it's the same with the ADL. And I guess the greater concern is that YouTube is now working with the ADL to weed out radical videos and things. Yeah, fine. If you've got stuff that's calling for murder and against any group and is literally inciting angry, destructive hatred, let it be isolated. But yeah, when I find out the ADL is working with YouTube on censorship issues, that concerns me. We've only got about a minute, but what's your take on that?
I think it's extremely alarming. If you look at the people who are on the list, some of those people would be described as like the top content producing conservatives in the movement right now. You have like Mike Cernovich was on the list. You have, I'm trying to think, like Gavin McGinnis. These are people who have very popular YouTube videos, very popular websites and Twitter accounts. And clearly they've already been wrongfully accused of being anti-Semites and Nazis. So I just see that, you know, this is a disaster waiting to happen when you have a group that wants to label everyone who disagrees with you, you know, a Nazi or a white supremacist, because, you know, I doubt they're going to also be like calling out these Islamic videos that call for expansion of Sharia and, you know, ISIS and Islamic indoctrination. So it's going to be funny because I'm sure that we'll still find those terrorist videos out there. But oh, no. Let's censor the conservative first.
Yeah. And that's often where it comes down. And friends, we're not being paranoid. These are things we're living out. This is something Laura's living out. You may agree with her politics, her activism or not. But what we do agree is we have the right to have this freedom of expression. And if we come against those who are inciting violence and hatred and anger, that means that we're the opposite of that. Hey, Laura, I hope you don't mind if I ask my listeners just to pray for you by name, that God's blessing would be yours, because I know it can be a little lonely there. So if you don't mind, we're going to be praying for you in days to come, all right?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Laura. Well, let's talk about the Hebrew Bible and English translations.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Turn that music down. There we go. Thank you. Michael Brown, glad to be with you today on The Line of Fire. And the phone lines are open. We had two terrific interviews in the first hour, because of which we did not take any calls. But the phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related question you have, as always, phone lines are open. But I want to focus today in some of what I talk about, but the Hebrew Bible itself and translating the Hebrew Bible into English. And I want to come back to some comments from Monday about the King James Version strengths and weaknesses. All right. So, again, my goal is to be edifying and helpful. Everything I'm saying as a lover of the Word since I came to faith at the age of 16. So for 45-plus years, digging into the Scriptures, almost 46 years now, digging into the Word, doing my best to understand the Word so I could best understand God and what He requires of me and requires of us. So I know many of you are fellow lovers of the Word. And in fact, we may have some passionate differences because we love the Word so much. All right, so I want to get to your calls. Again, they have to be specifically Jewish-related. Or even better, Hebrew Bible related, translation related. I'd love to get to some of those. 866-348-7884. Okay. Let me just mention something that came up on Monday when I was talking about strengths and weaknesses of the King James Version. And again, if you're just tuning in today, missed the Monday show, it's up on YouTube, on the Ask Dr. Brown YouTube channel or on the AskDrBrown.org website. It's getting a ton of comments already, just up for a little bit over a day. A lot of discussion there. And I hope to do the same with other versions, talk about strengths and weaknesses of other translations in the days ahead. No direct plan for when, but we'll let you know when we're going to be doing it. But it was only right and appropriate to start with the King James. So I mentioned the issue of the King James translating some verses with unicorn. Now, did the King James translators believe in some mythical unicorn, a horse with one horn? No, of course not. Of course not. Were they thinking about the rhinoceros? Perhaps they were. Some believe they were. Some believe that they were following Latin translation traditions that speak of the rhinoceros as unicorn, because there's some rhinoceri, is it plural, that have one horn and some have two horns. And there's some translation traditions that associate unicorn with rhinoceros. But I was saying, since unicorn does not have that meaning in English now, it's better to translate it differently. You say, so should it be rhinoceros? No, it shouldn't be. Virtually every modern translation that you'll see, including the New King James, will have wild ox. The Hebrew ra'im does not mean rhinoceros. It means wild ox. Some would suggest it could be a wild bull, all right? But either way, unicorn is not the right translation, because the wild ox does not have one horn, and because Hebrew ra'im is not unicorn. So either way, however you slice the cake, that needs to be corrected. And in the days of King James, if unicorn meant wild ox, that would make no sense again, because wild ox has two horns. You say, well, maybe looking at it from a certain angle, it could look like it has one horn. Whatever the discussion is, just it's the wrong word. That's all. It's the wrong word. And that's why, over decades, translators will look at their work again, look at it again, and realize, okay, we can improve this. We can fix this. We made a mistake here. It happens. We'll be right back.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Thanks for joining us. 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions, in particular related to the Hebrew Bible translation. That would be terrific. I want to get to as many calls as I can. But let me say something again so you don't miss this. I'm not assuming that every one of you has listened to all of my broadcasts over time. So let me repeat something I said on Monday. If you love the King James and that's your favorite translation, wonderful, great. I still think it's better to read then something like the New King James, or even better still, the MEV, the Modern English Version, which maintain the textual history of the King James and are very familiar in language and style and feel, but would have many improvements. But if you say, no, I prefer the King James, I love it, I grew up with it, I still find it unsurpassed, great, great. I'm not going to argue with that. However, here's where my argument's going to be. Don't tell me that it is a perfect translation, all right? My battle is with King James only people who say that it is a perfect translation, that all other translations are inferior or demonic or something like that. That is completely wrong. That is a deceived, erroneous position that I will flatly confront. If the King James is your favorite Bible, great, fine. That was my Bible, my one and only Bible when I got saved and poured through it day and night and was in the Word day and night, reading it and memorizing verses day and night and sharing the gospel and quoting scripture. And I still quote 45 years later from the King James, okay? And a few weeks ago, I was at a church that said, we use the King James here. I preached out of the King James, no problem. My issue is with those who make the false, erroneous, and utterly deceived claim that the King James is a perfect translation, that it is inspired just the way the original Hebrew, Greek scriptures were inspired. That's where I have an issue. But if you feel that King James is best at a certain point and want to argue against modern translation, fine, we can have that discussion. No problem. No problem whatsoever. All right, just want to make that clear up front. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll start with Patrick in South Haven, Mississippi. Welcome to the Line of Fire, or Missouri, sorry.
Hey, Dr. Brown. It's Mississippi, actually.
Mississippi. Yep, got it. Thanks.
Hey, so I had a question about translation in Psalm 2, specifically verse 12.
Yep.
My usual version is the New King James, and reading out of the...
We lost you there, Patrick. Boy, I don't know what happened, but let me answer your question. Psalm 2, verse 12, here's what we're familiar with seeing in most all of our Christian translations. So I hope you're still listening, sir. Psalm 2, verse 12, we are used to seeing these words, and this will be in virtually all of our English Bibles. We're used to seeing kiss the Son. Those are the key words. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish from the way when his wrath is kindled, but a little blessed are they that put their trust in him. Now, if you will look, say, at a Jewish translation, like the New Jewish Version, you'll read something very different. You'll read this, pay homage in good faith, lest he be angered, and your way be doomed in the mere flesh of his anger. Happy are all who take refuge in him. What's the problem? The problem is that elsewhere in the psalm, it speaks of God's Son, and it uses the standard Hebrew word ben for son. But then, when you get to Psalm 2, verse 12, it uses the Aramaic word for son, which is bar. So why make that switch? Doesn't seem to make sense, does it? You know, Simon bar Jonah, that's Simon's son of Jonah. Why switch from ben, son, to bar, son, in the same verse, in the same psalm? Why go from Hebrew to Aramaic? Now, you have, for example, in Proverbs 31:2, it uses bar there, the Aramaic word bar for son. But that's a totally separate context and apparently different language tradition there. But Psalm 2, it's all Hebrew. And then plus kiss the son, you would have expected something, you would have expected a preposition in there before the word son, the way the Hebrew grammar works, etc. So some have said, well, it probably doesn't mean sunny. When you look at the ancient versions have some very different readings as well. They seem confused as to what it exactly said. Some have said, well, it means nashak is kiss, but it means kiss in terms of pay homage. And instead of reading bar, sun, we should read bor, which is purity. And so so worship and purity. And there are tons of suggestions. I delivered a scholarly paper on this a couple of decades ago, wrote a very technical article on it, which I never got published. Probably should just update it and get it published. But it seems to be confusion here. Ah, I believe it must say sun. If it doesn't say sun, the whole thrust of the psalm goes out the window. You say, what do you mean? Well, let's take a look. Let's begin in Psalm 2, verse 1, all right? Psalm 2, verse 1, what does it say? And I'll read from the New King James. Why do the nations rage and the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, his Mashiach, his anointed. Now, initially, it may have been referring to King David at his coronation, and God had said to him that he'd be a father to the kings of Israel, the line of David, and they would be his sons. You find that, for example, in 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter. But here, the ultimate reference is the anointed one, the Messiah. So this is a coronation psalm of a son of David, ultimately about the son, the Messiah. All right, so who's the uproar against? It's against the Lord and his anointed king in Jerusalem. And when all these kings and rulers say, we're going to cast off their yoke, God says, verse 6, I've set my king on my holy hill of Zion. And then the king says, I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I'll give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O kings, be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the sun lest he be angry. Now that makes perfect sense contextually, because the kings are being told, you submit to God's son, the king in Jerusalem, or else. If you get rid of sun in verse 12, now the whole thing fades. It's just don't fight the Lord. Well, no, the rebellion is against the Lord and his anointed king in Jerusalem. Well, then why would it say bar, son, and Aramaic instead of Hebrew? Ah, because the nations are being addressed. And the lingua franca, the commonly spoken language in the Semitic world at that time was Aramaic. All right? Just like the most common Semitic language in the larger Semitic-speaking world today is Arabic. Back then, it was Aramaic. So if you want to speak to the nations, what do you do? Jeremiah 10:11, God speaks to the nations. And what language does he speak? Aramaic. It's an Aramaic verse in the middle of the Hebrew book of Jeremiah. It could even be that the verb nashak, kiss, which in Aramaic is the same verb, it could be an Aramaic verb as well. You just change the vowels because the vowels are not there in the original Hebrew text. So I believe that it should say this. Perhaps it even read, kiss his son. That's another argument that could be made. All right, but I believe you can support that grammatically and that is the right reading. If you want to find out more about that, then go to realmessiah.com. And if you look through objections, when you get to a little section on Psalm 2, I deal with that as well. Or if you have Volume 3, of my book, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, you'll find more there. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee. David, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you doing?
Doing very, very well, thank you.
Yes, well, first things first, I just wanted to know that, what are those huge differences between Jewish and Christian translations of the Bible, of the Old Testament?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, they fall into a few categories. One category would be messianic prophecy, where we would be, as followers of Jesus, much more inclined to recognize a messianic prophecy. Let's say you had two different ways to translate it, one that would seem to point more to Jesus, another that might not. Christian translators would tend to see Jesus. In other words, when you have two legitimate choices. So messianic prophecy, that would be one area. Another area would be theological differences. that, for example, Genesis 15:6, Abraham believed the Lord and it was counted to him for righteousness. Judaism has a little bit different understanding there. It would say it was counted to his merit. So sometimes you see theological differences. So differences in interpreting messianic prophecy, theological differences, and then just translation traditions, that certain words, phrases through the Jewish commentators have been understood in certain ways that Christian scholars have understood a little bit differently, and therefore will translate them a little differently. Those are the main areas where you would see differences. All right, stay right there. We'll continue on the other side of the break.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, that Hebrew music, Hebrew singing, gives you that feeling of security, and it's thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And all is well. Michael Brown here. Thanks so much for joining us. Taking questions that focus in particular on the Hebrew Bible and Bible translation, but if they're Jewish related, then they're welcome today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And remember, I absolutely welcome calls from folks who differ with me. The only request I have is if you have an agenda, put it up front. In other words, don't ask me a baiting question that I'll just answer in a certain way and then you come back with your counterattack. If you're looking for a specific response, ask me for it, and I'll do my best to give it to you. And also, if you ask me a question, allow me to answer it. This way I can be of help to you. Fair enough? 866-34-TRUTH. So, Dave in Nashville, back to you. So that was your general question. Did you have a specific follow-up?
Well, yeah. I remember, I think it was last week that I called about Christians' lack of use of the Old Testament in a lot of doctrinal matters. And I think one important, I think you wrote a book on Israel's divine healer, which you treated that, like the concept of God healing throughout the Old Testament. And I feel that within Christianity, that's kind of lacking. But I remember that last week. And also, I guess, do you think Jewish commentators of the Bible could be important for a biblical study of the Hebrew Bible?
Well, yeah, they've been used, David. And by the way, somehow you may have gotten past our call screeners because we don't allow calls within a couple weeks, just to be fair to others. But thanks for your zeal, sir. Yeah, Christian translators for centuries, even go back to the King James, have learned from Hebrew Bible commentaries because many of the great medieval commentaries, for example, the so-called Big Three, Rashi and Ibn Ezra and Radak, so beginning in, what, the 11th, 12th, 13th centuries thereabouts, some of these great commentators had tremendous familiarity with the Hebrew language, phenomenal familiarity with it. I'd say other parts, because of their views and their traditions, they missed other things in Scripture. Of course, they'd make that accusation against us. But they have been used with profit for centuries, but could be used even more. If you'll look, sir, at my commentary on Jeremiah in the Expositor's Bible Commentary Series, the revised edition of the Expositor's Bible Commentary Series, more than any other commentator, I used the Hebrew commentaries a lot. And then obviously certain places we're going to have differences and see things differently. And that's where I would say that their perspective is blinding them from seeing certain things. And they would feel my perspective is blinding me from seeing certain things. But certainly they're of value and they are regularly used. They could be used more because of great familiarity with the Hebrew text. But because we all come with certain traditions and backgrounds, sometimes those things can be helpful. Sometimes they can be unhelpful, but they are used widely. They should be used more widely. That would be my viewpoint. Hey, thank you, David. I appreciate it. 866-348-7884. Let's go to Fab in Boston. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Fab. Or hi, Dr. Brown. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Good. So, okay. to the King James Version, which I like the King James Version. I like the 1611, the Authorized King James. I even like the Geneva Bible and the Tyndale Bible. I like them all.
Wait, so hang on. Just one thing real quick. You actually read the original Tyndale, the original 1611, King James, the original Geneva?
Yeah, I do that for research. I mean, I have them. I go to them frequently.
Okay, I mean, because the English is really, the spelling is different, and the English is very, very different than, okay.
Well, the 1611, I actually have a copy, an actual copy of the 1611, you know, with all the artwork, and it is very different, but I'm used to it. So.
Got it, okay. No, I just want to clarify, because a lot of folks say King James 1611, and they mean the most modern revision of the King James that's widely used. But you're talking about the legitimate 1611. Right. Got it. All clear.
Yeah, yeah. I go to that, and you're right. A lot of things are spelled differently, and words.
Yeah, you have to get used to it. Yep.
Yeah, the letters are even different. However, I'm with you in the fact that I do not agree with King James onlyists, okay, because I'm of the belief that the King James Bible, regardless of the version, does have error in it. And one of the things that I've often focused on is the word Easter. And so I'm commenting under your thread, and there's a gentleman there who posted a link because he believes that Easter is the proper translation. And the reason being is on this link it says that neither Jews nor Herod were the ones using the word Easter, but that Luke was actually using the word Easter to denote a specific timeline of events, basically saying that he was a Christian narrator. And the individual that was typing this on your thread, he was espousing that, you know, Herod was a pagan, and he wanted to wait until Easter before crucifying, rather than letting the Jews do it. And so his take on all of this is that due to the timeline that he subscribes to, that basically he believes that Easter is the right translation.
Yeah, and in fact, I've just got to jump in, Fab, because your phone call is kind of cutting in and out, and I know what you're saying, so let me respond. It is a mistranslation. It is a mistranslation. Simple fact. It is a mistranslation to say Easter in Acts chapter 12. When Luke was writing Acts, there was no such thing as Easter. No one in the world, no human being on the planet had ever heard of something called Easter that celebrated the death and resurrection of the Messiah. I'm not saying you shouldn't celebrate it. It's a totally separate issue, okay? And whatever chronological argument you want to make, that's easily dismissed anyway, all right? But if we look at the King James in Acts, the 12th chapter, King James in Acts, the 12th chapter, here's what it says. And let me just click on it to get there in my translation here, all right? So King James, it's talking about Herod persecuting the believers there, killing James, the brother of John, and then taking Peter in to kill him as well, Acts 12:4. When he apprehended him, he put him in prison, delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people. How does the King James, New King James read? After Passover. How does every English translation read? After Passover. How does the ancient Aramaic read? The same thing. It's after Passover. How does the Greek read? Which is the only question. How does the Greek read? It's ta Pascha, the Passover. How is this translated everywhere else in the King James? Passover. I don't care what chronology anyone is arguing for. It is a mistranslation. It should have been corrected centuries ago. And I believe if the King James translators had another go at it, they would have fixed it. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We are...
מן השעות והשניות והקולות באוזניות מן הכוכב על המגדל ומן הרוח לצידו
Welcome, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown, your Thoroughly Jewish host, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. That is the number to call, and the phones are open with your questions about the Hebrew Bible translation, or general Jewish-related questions. Glad to take your calls today, 866-34-TRUTH. May I read to you from the King James of Job chapter 28? When I translated the book of Job for a commentary that I'm working on, just doing a major revision on it. That's why it's not out yet. We're changing the approach of it to try to make it more approachable, more readable for a larger audience, less technical. So I'm doing a major rewrite on it. But translating the book of Job was difficult. The commentary was challenging but exhilarating. Translating was often more challenging than exhilarating. It is the most difficult book in the Hebrew Bible to translate, universally recognized as such. And not just the philosophical challenges, but the linguistic challenges. Very difficult. So you think, well, if I just read Hebrew, it'd be easier. Stay with the English, unless you want to put a lot of hard work for many, many years. So Job 28, I'm going to read it to you from the King James Version. All right? So we start in verse 1. Surely there is a vein for the silver, and a place for gold where they fine it. Iron is taken out of the earth, and brass is molten out of the stone. He setteth an end to darkness, and searcheth out all perfection, the stones of darkness and the shadow of death. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant, even the waters forgotten of the foot. They are dried up, they are gone away from men. At this point, you might be saying, what? The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant, even the waters forgotten of the foot, they are dried up, they are gone away from men. What in the world does that mean? As for the earth, out of it cometh bread, and under it it is turned up as if it were fire. Huh. Pretty hard to understand. Well, let's read the exact same text, but let's read it this time in the ESV, all right? Surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. So King James fine is modern English refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper is smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out to the farthest limit the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He opens up shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. What it's talking about is mining techniques and human beings digging, and they can find silver and gold, but they can't find wisdom. And for example, let's contrast verse 4 in the King James. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant, even the waters forgotten of the foot. They are dried up, they are gone away from men. That's virtually unintelligible. The flood breaketh out from the inhabitant. No, it's not a flood, it's a shaft. New King James, he breaks open a shaft away from people, and places forgotten by feet. They hang far away from men. They swing to and fro. Talking about miners digging and swinging under the earth. That's what it's talking about. So we simply have better translations, better understanding. And the King James translators did nobly, but we have better understanding of the Hebrew. We have more manuscript evidence. We have better understanding of some of ancient archaeological finds and things like that. So why not use the great improvements God has given us? But either way, if you love the King James, fine. No problem with it. My issue is very simply this. Do not make the bogus, fallacious claim that it is a perfect translation. It is not.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to 30 Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown here taking your calls, especially on Hebrew Bible-related questions, but taking wider questions as well on this 30 Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Atlanta, Georgia. Joe, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown. How are you today?
Doing very well. Thank you, sir.
I had a question about Numbers 14:18. This came up in a Sunday school lesson about a year ago and caused some controversy. In the Holman, it says that in the latter part of the verse that God bring the consequences of the father's wrongdoing on the children to the third and fourth generation. Then in the NIV, it says that he punishes the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. I do understand that to some people, consequences and punishment can be the same thing. But I was curious, what is the more accurate translation of that text?
Yeah. First, I would say that visiting the iniquity is the way I would translate it. And it's interesting, the Hebrew poked avon iniquity, no difference on that. But poked, or from the root pakad, is a very interesting verb. It has a wide variety of meanings. Whole books have even been written just on the verb. But you'll normally see it as meaning visit, right, as a fundamental meaning. So visiting the iniquity, some might think that's just a little bit too literal, okay? The Complete Jewish Bible says causing the negative effects of the parents' offenses to be experienced by their children. That's pretty expansive there, all right? So the NIV, in its translation style, is going to try to make it a little bit more smooth on a literary level, right? So punishes the children for the sins of the parents, but that doesn't convey the reality. Punishes the children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation, yes, but visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children just makes it a little bit clearer. So, yes, it is saying that there is a punishment that comes with it. All right. In other words, okay, Both are telling you something accurate. That and the way the Complete Jewish Bible puts it is really good. It's a bit expansive. Causing the negative effects of the parents' offenses to be experienced by their children. So, if I was a totally profligate father and an alcoholic and abusive, the effects of that get visited on the kids. And if the kids are then God-rejecting and following my footsteps, then it gets even worse for their kids, and we're sowing what we're reaping. But the NIV doesn't say it as exactly, and can give you the idea that, say, if I sin terribly and you're my son, that God will punish you for my sin as opposed to visit the consequences of my sin on you. So the nuance is missing there in the NIV. And although I understand why they translate it like that, it's definitely not the best way, in my view.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Brown. That makes a lot of sense.
You are very welcome, for sure. 866-348-7884. Let us go to Tampa. Oh, we won't go there. Instead, let's see. We'll go to Decatur, Alabama. Brett, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks.
Hey, I've got a question, and you're just the man for the answer, I'll bet. Is there an ancient Hebrew word that can be translated coincidence?
Yeah, it'd be more chance. It's the Hebrew word mikre, mikre from the root kofresh, hey. Kara means to happen, something happening. And if you just say it just happened, it's just a mikra. And in other words, it's not like I planned this out or you planned this out. So it's not so much coincidence. It wouldn't quite have that nuance, but just something that happened. That would be the Hebrew word mikra. And it's used in the Bible. Here and there you have it. So it's I didn't plan this in advance. You didn't plan this in advance. It's just something that happened. And, you know, you got a flat tire driving down the road. It happened, as opposed to somebody put nails down in the road to get to your tire.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. I'm sure that ties in with a larger theological discussion that Brett may be having with someone, but we're good with that. 866 for Truth. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida. Sean, by the way, I think it's the third Sunday of August that I'm scheduled to be preaching in Jacksonville, Florida. Maybe I'll run into
really?
You, but yeah. It's on my itinerary. If you go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org, check the itinerary, and you'll find it there.
Okay, I'll be looking forward to that.
All right. Yes, sir.
Just really quick question. Would you say that Messianic Judaism is an error because it seems to somewhat still uphold the feast days and the Sabbath? You know, it seems as maybe they're leaning towards the works of Moses, per se, by still holding these things, even though they're claiming Yeshua as Messiah?
Sean, you may have some Messianic Jews that are legalistic and that have a works orientation, but no, Messianic Jews are just saying that we want to live the way Jesus Yeshua lived and the way Paul lived and the way Peter lived and the way Jewish believers lived for several centuries. And in other words, because the Messiah came, he said he didn't come to abolish but to fulfill. So we now, the Messianic Jews, would celebrate the feast with larger meaning. In other words, we celebrate the Passover remembering the Exodus and remembering the Messiah's death and resurrection. We celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles looking forward to the final ingathering of the nations. So Messianic congregations are just seeking to restore some of the Jewish roots that were cut off in church history. You have to realize that initially it was all Jewish, sir. And the question was, where do Gentiles fit? Because you had all these Jews that were keeping the Sabbath and that were keeping the feasts. And when Paul writes to the Corinthians, he assumes they know about Passover and he assumes they know the Jewish calendar and things like that. And many of the Gentiles got saved because they used to attend the synagogues. They were attracted to the God of Israel, but they didn't want to convert to Judaism. And when Paul preached Jesus, like, wow, so we can have equal rights along with the Jews and be accepted by God the same way without keeping the law of Moses? Yeah. But they were very familiar with the law. Now Paul's saying, yeah, you can have equal status with those that keep the law through faith in the Messiah. So the question was, where do Gentiles fit? Do Gentiles have to become Jews in order to be saved? And the answer was, no, they don't. And we find that in Acts 15. But it was always understood that Jews could live as Jews. And that's why Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, he says there, if you're saved when you're called, right, meaning saved, and you're circumcised, don't become uncircumcised. You're saved as a Jew? Great. Live as a Jew, but now in Jesus by the Spirit. If you're saved uncircumcised, saved as a Gentile, that's when you get called to salvation, you're uncircumcised, stay that way. Don't become circumcised. Don't try to become a Jew. And this way, Jew and Gentile together, just like male and female together, make up one new man in the Messiah. So you may have some congregations that go off, but the church has gone off the other way. So many of my dear friends, Messianic leaders, I minister often in Messianic settings, and it's just the full appreciation of the New Testament faith from their perspective. Do some go backwards? Do some go in the wrong direction? Absolutely. When Jewishness becomes more important than Jesus, we're going in the very wrong direction. But to worship God through a Jewish Messiah and to find the fullness of the biblical calendar, great. Why not? Hey, thank you for the call. I want to try to get to as many calls as I can. 866-348-7884. We go to Mark in Richmond, Virginia. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Brown. My question is in regards to the Dead Sea Scrolls. If they were written in either Hebrew or Aramaic, and I heard also that there was a scroll of Isaiah that was found back when they discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that writing of Isaiah is nearly identical to the one that we had all along. I was wondering if you could comment on that, please, whether or not that's accurate.
Yeah, so, of course, Dead Sea Scrolls, a treasure trove of scrolls discovered in the 1940s in various caves in Qumran and by the Dead Sea, and maybe the greatest biblically-related archaeological discovery of all time. Because before then, the oldest complete manuscript that we had of the Hebrew Bible was from about 1,000 years after Jesus, called the Leningrad B-19A. So stored in a library in Leningrad, that's how it got that name. That was the oldest complete copy we had of the Hebrew Bible, because as the Bibles would wear out, they'd be buried or stored in places, and so we wouldn't have them anymore. So you think 1,000 years after Jesus, and a lot of the Hebrew Bible is written 1,500 years or 1,000 years before Jesus, what about the gap there? So when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, Yeah, it was a massively important discovery. And there are two primary Isaiah scrolls that were discovered. The Isaiah A scroll is the entire book of Isaiah, but it's written by somewhat of a free-handed scribe, and it has many spelling differences from our version of Isaiah. However, the Isaiah B scroll, which is smaller, is virtually letter for letter, the exact same thing as what we have in our Hebrew Bibles today. So the answer is, yes, sir, that is accurate.
It's fire we want, for fire we please.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, we've got one more segment left on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And by the way, I'm unable to get to all the calls. I get to as many as I can, but tomorrow phone lines will be open as well, and your calls are always welcome. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Holden in Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thanks.
I had a boss at one time that was Jewish, and he used to go to Torah study once a week. And we were having a conversation, and I said, Isaiah is my favorite book in the whole Bible. He said, the first Isaiah or the second Isaiah? And that kind of threw me, because I said, well, I only know of one Isaiah book. Are there two different books in the Hebrew Bible?
All right, there is one book of Isaiah, period. The dispute among scholars is, were there two different Isaiahs that wrote it, or two different authors of the book of Isaiah? Some even claim there were three. So basically, through history, it was understood there was one Isaiah. And when the rabbinic writings, the ancient Jewish writings, New Testament writings would speak of Isaiah, they spoke of Isaiah, period. Just one person, one author. If you look in John chapter 12, it combines Isaiah 6 and Isaiah 53 as if written by the same author. So that would have been the perspective of the New Testament writers, the ancient rabbis, through history. You get some hints of a question about this about 1,000 years ago by a Jewish scholar named Ibn Ezra. But it was only a couple hundred years ago that scholars began to look at this more. And here's the problem. Isaiah 1 through 39 deals with certain events within the lifetime of certain kings like Ahab and Hezekiah and things like that. And Isaiah 39 ends with a prophecy of the Babylonian exile. And then Isaiah 40 starts with words of comfort to the exiles in Babylon roughly 150 years later. All right? So it's obviously not the same guy alive then. So you say, well, he just prophesied it. In other words, Isaiah 40 starts with words of prophecy and comfort to the exiles in Babylon and talks about coming out of Babylon. But other scholars, especially if they're not looking at this in a supernatural way, they would say, wait a second. That's obviously a later author that wrote this. And then some divide it in three parts. Isaiah 1 to 39, they call first Isaiah. And then Isaiah 40 to 55, second Isaiah. And then they find a whole third set, third Isaiah, 56 to 66. So in short, Holden, number one, in the Bible, there's one book of Isaiah. And conservatives say Isaiah the prophet wrote these things and then prophesied things for future generations in the Spirit. Others would say maybe he passed some of these on to his disciples. And then later, his disciples, speaking for their master Isaiah, then put these things out as well. You know, maybe that's what happened, or they passed them on later. And liberal scholars, critical scholars, say obviously no one prophesies the future like that, so there have to be two different Isaiahs or maybe three. But as a lover of the word, reader of Scripture, read it as one book of Isaiah, and you're perfectly safe and sound to do that, okay?
Oh, thank you so much.
Sure thing. Very welcome. I hope I didn't confuse things in my answer there. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Zach in Richmond. You're on the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Michael Brown, how are you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
So I have a question about Bible translations.
Yep.
I've been walking through King James Version, and you've been citing New King James Version as the alternative.
Yeah, or the Modern English Version, the MEV, I like even better.
Right. Since the New King James Version seems to have some problems with translations also. They almost translated for you, as in Judges with Jephthah. They were calling him a worthless fellow, but and he went out from them. And they were talking about how he was raiding, in the New King James Version, he was going out with the worthless fellows, raiding houses. And when I read the ESV, it just seems like he was gathering around with worthless fellows who were worthless in the eyes of the Hebrews. So I was just seeing if you could shed some light on that.
Yeah, so I'm looking in Judges 12 where it's talking about Jephthah. Is it earlier than that in the 11th chapter, the verse that you're speaking of specifically? Do you remember where exactly?
I'm pretty sure it's right at the beginning of 12.
Got it.
It's somewhere
okay.
Like right in the beginning.
Yep. All right. So let's just look. That's where I looked initially. But yeah, let me just say, because I'm familiar with the Hebrew text, there are. What we need to understand is this. I read the English Bible all the time, and then, of course, I read in Hebrew, and I'll study in Greek. I can't read the Greek as well as I read the Hebrew. But I feel totally secure reading a Bible in English, knowing that on all major points, it's clear, and on all major points on how God wants me to live and what pleases him and how to share the gospel with others, it's clear, okay? But once you start to dig, you'll find hundreds, thousands of cases where you just can't decide the exact way to say it or the best way, or there are two different possible ways to go in the Hebrew or in the Greek. And in fact, Zach, when I was translating the book of Job from my commentary, what I really wrestled with was the simple verses, because there were like so many different ways to say it in English. And I think, okay, what is the best way to say it? So in this case, and I'll just look, say in the New King James, and let's see, we'll just look for the word raid, okay, and see if we can spot it like that to see the exact verse you're speaking of, because again, as I said, there are Judges 11. It's beginning of the 11th chapter. That was it. So here's what you have to look at. The New King James has the word raiding in italics, meaning they added that in, thinking that that's what it was talking about. But you'll see almost all other translations just say worthless people followed him or went out with him. He enlisted a gang of rowdies who go out. Now, I do see other translations that do say raiding. The Hebrew just says went out with him. However, they would suggest that it means went out to raid, and that you can find that usage. But the literal translation of the Hebrew is simply they went out with him. And there are some traditions, even some Jewish translation traditions, that suggest it means they went out to raid. But I agree, it shouldn't be there. But by the way, you'll find that with the King James, whenever a word is not in the original Hebrew or Greek, they'll put it in italics. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they add it in, and it's not there. Like in the Gospels where there are two thieves on either side of Jesus, and one of them is reviling and says, you know, the other cast the same into his teeth. None of those words are there in the Greek, cast the same into his teeth. It's just, it was a King James English idiom for reviled, but none of those words are actually there. But you're right, Zach, I would say the ESV is more accurate there. But if you'll study all the translations, you're going to find one place you like one verse better than another, and another better. So have one primary one that you read from, memorize, get to know, get a study Bible there, and then read the other translations supplementally. I think that's really helpful and healthy. Hey, friends, if you have not yet gone to SavingASickAmerica.com, go there today.